I'm turning now to the book of Daniel, chapter 3 and verse 1. The book of Daniel, chapter 3, verse 1. We come to this point in our series of studies in this extraordinary and wonderful prophetic book. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold, whose height was 70 cubits, and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura, in the province of Babylon. And our subject is persecution of God's people in Babylon. Persecution strikes. Now there are so many attacks made on this passage, this third chapter of the book of Daniel, and most of them are unrealistic and petty, and I don't propose to deal with them this evening. At the heart, of course, of the chapter is a great miracle of deliverance, and naturally those people who reject miracles, God's power to do wonderful things, well, they find it unrealistic and dismiss it, and they fail to see the extraordinary nature of what God did, various attributes of his action, the subtleties of the passage. They fail to appreciate the narrative and the quality of the miracle and its accomplishments. Well, the miracle of deliverance for the friends of Daniel, the three men, Daniel not being included in this chapter at all, the miracle was necessary for the preservation of the people of God. What is proposed in this chapter is something akin to genocide. Now, the way Daniel writes the chapter later in his ministry as a prophet, under inspiration, the way he writes it, he imputes no prior motives to Nebuchadnezzar. He doesn't interpret the event for us. He simply records it. And because of this, we may interpret it or read it in a very naive manner. Oh, Nebuchadnezzar has issued this great decree. He's erected this image. And surprise, surprise, who is caught out but the Jewish members of his administration, as though that was not to be expected. And it's a big surprise. And so the Chaldeans, the astrologers, accused the Jews to Nebuchadnezzar, and often it's said, oh, he was quite dismayed to discover that some of his favorites were caught out by his decree and were falling foul of his threats. And so he initially pleads with them, but then he must preserve his honor and his integrity and goes to execute them and so on. Well, nothing of the kind. We mustn't read it in a naive manner. It's perfectly obvious that this was intended, that all this was exactly what Nebuchadnezzar intended, to bring into absolute submission to him and to his way and to his will the Jewish members of his administration, Daniel and the three others in particular, who had been captured from Jerusalem and had become graduates in his own staff college, as it were, in Babylon, and to bring them into complete submission to himself, or they must perish. They had become an embarrassment to him. They had become an annoyance to him in his great pride. When did this take place? Well, we don't know, but presumably he sets up this image at the height of his power, when he's subdued all his enemies, when his empire is as large as it could conceivably be. And now, puffed up by pride, so elevated, he thinks he can bring to submission all those Jewish members of his administration, of his government regionally, and those who do not submit to him, well, they will perish. He feels he's been undermined by them, perhaps. Mutterings at court. those Chaldeans who are jealous of their promotion and their power, of the Jews, that is, and saying, well, the king is weak. He tolerates people who will not bow to the Babylonian gods or regard them as supreme. That was the thinking of the heathen, the pagan world. The conqueror's gods must be more powerful than the others. If you were a conquered heathen, you could keep your gods and your own superstitions and beliefs, as long as you recognized that the gods of your conquerors were actually more powerful than yours, because that nation had conquered you. Oh, there was toleration of all the different national deities, divinities, gods, but in the case of the Jews, it was different, because the Hebrews believed that theirs was the only God, and no other existed, and all others were myth and a lie and an abomination, and they would not accept them, acknowledge them, or worship them. The king is weak because he tolerates people with this intolerable attitude, and it's an affront to him and his reign. We've seen a weakness in the king, and the great king cannot stand that. So now the Jews must be brought into submission. Well, that's the king's reasoning I'm telling you about. But behind it all is, of course, Satan, who has put this fury and rage and injured pride into the heart of the king. And the king thinks he's preserving his authority and unity of the empire, and of course self-aggrandizement also. But actually it's Satan who wishes to destroy the plan of salvation, of redemption, who wishes to destroy the people from whom will come the Messiah, who wishes in whatever way he can to prevent the whole plan of God, which of course he cannot do. Well, what is the solution going to be? Are masses of Babylonians, the Nebuchadnezzar, his authority, his staffs, his soldiers, his people, going to perish? Is there going to be a confrontation? Because God will overrule in such a way that even that disobedient Jewish nation, because the promised seed must come, the Messiah must be born, well, they've to be preserved at all costs. Will lives be lost? Will there be a confrontation? No, the economy of God is quite marvelous. There will be a miracle that will deliver three highly placed offenders that will change the mind of the king, and the only people who will perish is a few of his leading hero soldiers who were unfortunate enough to be too near to the flames. What a remarkable thing that the whole course of history will be changed, a genocide edict or decree will be reversed without loss of life. So the miracle is necessary, because it's not the preservation of three men only, three believers, it's the preservation effectively of a coherent people of God. They're going to be destroyed, or they're going to renounce their faith and submit. That's the only way they can exist. So it's a remarkable passage. These are very sophisticated narratives, and you see in them the marvelous way in which God works. So we'll go through. Verse 1, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold. An image of what? Well, we're not told. Some people think it was an image of Nebuchadnezzar, but it doesn't say. Some people think it was an image of Marduk, the principal Babylonian god, or it was a fusion of their gods, or it was all of them. Nebuchadnezzar possibly in part, partly deifying himself, and other gods also. But anyway, it was a huge thing, some 90 feet tall, and the experts point out that it was 10 times taller than it was wide, which strange proportions. They all like to point out that a human form, well, the ratio would be 6 times taller than it was wide, But then we're told nothing about the height of the pedestal, and all these ancient monuments had pedestals, so we really can't analyze too much what it looked like, except that it was huge. Then people say, there's no way in which even Nebuchadnezzar with his riches would have had that much gold. But then it was very likely constructed of timber and overlaid with gold. Oh, but it says it's of gold. Yes, but that's the customary way of describing these objects. It's the same with the description of the temple, things that are overlaid with gold in the instructions for them to be made are later described as being made of gold. It's a kind of shorthand. So it's quite acceptable to think that this was basically a timber core overlaid with gold for all its hugeness. But anyway, here it is, and it's put in the plain, or rather the valley of Dura. Some people like to identify it as a place about 6 miles south of ancient Babylon, where, whether it's so or not, there is a candidate for the base, which has been long known to archaeologists, a huge brick, plausible foundation for such a statue as this in its size. But anyway, there it is. Verse 2, then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent together the princes, they'll be the regional governors, I expect, though it's difficult to be precise with these terms, governors, captains, military rulers, judges, treasurers, counselors, sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces. There must have been hundreds of them. Some people say 200, some people say 1,000, which I think is probably nearer the mark, from throughout the empire, principal rulers and people, and they're brought to Babylon for the dedication of the image. What happens in Babylon is going to be repeated throughout the empire, but all these principal people are going to be there in Babylon. That's going to satisfy the ego of Nebuchadnezzar, to have the statue which is associated with him and his rule and his power and success, and everybody, thousands of his principal princes, rulers, standing in front of it. And when a crashing chord sounds from a vast orchestra, they're all going to go flat on the ground in front of it. Well, it's allegiance, an oath of allegiance, not only worship to the Babylonian gods, but an oath of allegiance to the great Nebuchadnezzar, the like of whom have never been seen. Verse 3, then the princes, governors, captains, judges, treasurers. This is all a piece of satire on the part of Daniel, you know, as the inspired author. You might think this is a touch of the primitive. It isn't, because in all the court documents, as it were, and this paraphernalia of going through all the names repeatedly, adding a sense of grandness, that was the idea. Decrees had to be uttered in full. And so it seems to me that Daniel, when later under inspiration he writes all this, is a gentle satire going, it's a kind of parody of the very thing that would happen. And the person who would announce what was going to happen would go solemnly through all the officers and all the instruments repeatedly every time. It's to give you a flavor of court and what it was like and how the build-up was achieved and the atmosphere was sustained and so on. Then the princes, verse 3, captains, judges, treasurers, counselors, sheriffs, everybody was there, and they stood before the image, waiting for cue to prostrate themselves before that image representing Nebuchadnezzar. And verse 4, the herald issues the command, and the decree is not only to those present, but to all the citizens in all the regions represented by them. All this is going to happen there also. The orchestra is listed in verse 5, the cornet, which is a kind of horn or the trumpet at the time, a flute, which is a pipe, a sackbut, Well, I don't know what that was. The experts say it was a kind of trombone, but that would seem ahead of its time. But anyway, I've not seen a satisfactory explanation of that, and I've seen many very curious pictures of what is alleged to be a sackbut from the orchestra of Nebuchadnezzar, but I don't think anyone really knows. Psaltery, that's a stringed instrument, dulcimer, and all kinds of music. You shall fall down. So there's a great climax when this happens. Verse 6, the negative part of the decree. Whoso falleth not down and worshippeth shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace, like a great kiln that was already constructed and roaring, with a staircase presumably, and victims would be hurled in at the top, but a great aperture at the bottom. And you've seen these kind of things and pictures of them, I'm sure. I remember as a youngster going on a trip visit to a dust destructor in a city once and being quite astonished by it. I have a dim recollection of it. And we stood at the bottom and the great doors were opened where you could just see the fire and the flues turning and rushing up and see that heat, and there'd be an aperture at the bottom. I imagine that the three governors, Jewish governors, were hurled in at the top and walked out of the bottom aperture, the hottest part. That's just my imagination. But there is the threat. The power of the king is going to be established. People will either submit or they will perish on the spot. And he's intended this to catch those Jewish members of his administration, right down to ordinary citizens throughout the empire, who will not acknowledge that the Babylonian gods are the supreme and superior gods, and at the same time indicate their allegiance to him as the greatest king ever. Well, verse 7 continues the narrative and tells how all those officers fell down. It doesn't tell us this, but somewhere in the front row of the hundreds, the front two rows or three rows, because the governors of the regions would have surely been in the front, there were three men who did not fall to the ground. There they were, conspicuous, the three Jewish men. Daniel isn't there. There are as many reasons offered as to why Daniel wasn't there as there are verses in the chapter. But we don't know why he wasn't there. Was he sick? Was he elsewhere on diplomatic business? Was it that he was deliberately left out of all this because he was in such a high position, he was somewhat untouchable? And Nebuchadnezzar wanted the three slightly lower ranked officials to perish first, and then there would be no room left for Daniel. What was in his cunning mind? But you must have it in your head that the intention from the very beginning was to bring to submission the Jews or destroy them. And there are these three men, they're standing there. Verse 8, don't be naive when you read this. What follows now is just what the king expected. Some of his servile Chaldean astrologers did exactly what the king expected and wanted. This cruelty was not going to appear to be the king's initiative. Verse 8, wherefore at that time, surprise, surprise, certain Chaldeans, the term used in the book of Daniel for the astrologer class, the wise men, came near and accused the Jews. It's probably a few years since all their lives were saved by Daniel. You remember in the previous chapter, they were all going to be destroyed, the wise men of Babylon, And it's only because under God Daniel could interpret the king's dream that everyone was preserved. But they've chosen to forget that. They hate him. They hate the Daniel and the friends associated with him. They came near and accused the Jews. Verse 9, they spake and said to the king, O king, live forever. Thou, O king, hast made a decree. And they go through it in the customary detail, as they were obliged to do. And they accuse the Jews of not falling down. Verse 11, and whoso falleth not down and worshippeth, that he should be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image. Verse 13, Nebuchadnezzar, he'd hoped, I expect, if there was any regret in him, that they would simply submit. In his rage and fury, is it synthetic? No, I think it's real rage and fury. Satan puts it into his mind, these are the people who make you look small, who detract from your authority and your power. He commanded to bring them, and he goes through the motions of questioning them. In verse 14, is it true? Translation which has been challenged for many years until recently, interestingly. Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Do not ye serve my gods? He knew perfectly well they didn't. Nor worship the golden image. Now he gives them a second opportunity, but I don't think it's genuine. You may quarrel about that, but I don't think it's a genuine opportunity. He just wishes this to vindicate himself. And he gives them another opportunity to, but at the end of verse 15, a sentence that, phrase rather, that we catches our mind, and who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? Nebuchadnezzar, who'd been so impressed, and such a deep impression had been made on him when Daniel was able to describe to him his dream and interpret it to him. And he was humbled for a time, but he's got over that in his great pride. Why his gods must be superior to those of any other nation. Who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? He's got contempt now for the God of the Jews. But that's not why God works the miracle. It's to deliver his people. Verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. And I think the best way of rendering that is something like this. We do not wish to give an answer, O king. It is not necessary for us to answer for ourselves. You know we're not going to worship your gods. We cannot make a defense. We're not going to ask for mercy, because you know perfectly well, O king. And I'm sure it's very respectfully put, we're not going to worship your gods. There is only one God, the God of Israel. That's what they mean, in effect. We are not careful. We do not wish or need to answer you. And then in verse 17, if it be so, they have absolute confidence in God. Our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning, fiery furnace. Your modern translations wreck it. If God is able to deliver us, they mostly go for words along those lines, which is not doing justice to the text. But our King James Version has crafted it very carefully. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able, but it may not be his will, they imply. Maybe we must die as martyrs. And we are willing to do that. But if he is willing to deliver us, I can assure you, O King Nebuchadnezzar, he can. And he can do so easily. If he is not willing, because in his perfect wisdom, I'm adding to the text, he has another course in mind, then still we will not acknowledge your gods. They are a fiction, O King. There is only one God. If it be so, our God whom we serve, it's verse 17, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand. Verse 18, but if not, if he chooses not to deliver us, be it known unto thee, O King, we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Now you and I are put on test by the world time after time. But I can confidently say none of us has ever been threatened with a burning fiery furnace or death. I think there were one or two people here who have been threatened with violence. But not most. How easy it is for us to stand by comparison. They could see the furnace just there. They knew what would happen to them, that it was certain. But they were loyal to the Lord and looked to him, and they were willing even to perish. We should never be afraid of tests, dear friends. When we consider the courage of so many. Verse 19, then was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury. Pride demands revenge. And the form of his visage was changed. His hatred and detestation as the one true and living God, and his obstinate, no, loyal servants was so plain. And he hated Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spake and commanded that they should heat the furnace 7 times more. Don't worry about the mathematics, dear friends. He just wanted it as hot as it could possibly be. Increase the draft at the bottom. Pour in more fuel, whatever they were using. And then he did a curious thing. This is pure theatre. Verse 20. He commanded the most mighty men that were in his army, the VCs, if you like, the heroes, the senior men who had been capable of what they regarded as conspicuous valor, mighty, powerful people. It was a symbol of his own power to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So here's the build-up. They're now bound by the most powerful heroes in the military. And they'd taken up that staircase, which I assume was there, and they're cast, bundled, thrown over the side into this terrible furnace. As they are in their full dress uniform as regional governors. Verse 21, they're bound in their coats, their hosen, and their hats, and their other garments, and cast in, it's repeated. And because it all had to be done in response to the king's command, instantly, verse 22, those hero knights, well, they themselves perished in the heat because everything had been stoked up so much. And verse 23, it's repeated again. What happened to them at the end of the verse? They fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then there's that word, Nebuchadnezzar the king was astonished. He trembled. He shook. He blanched. He was alarmed. And he rose involuntarily, suddenly, in haste. And he spoke and said to his counselors, did we not cast three men bound? They said, true. And verse 25, look at the list of things. Four men. And one who says, well, don't forget, we're looking at this through the eyes of a pagan king. It's what he sees in his estimation, one like a son of a god. There was something unreal and divine, whether it was the Son of God, very possible, a theophany to those three suffering men, or whether it was an angel, as Nebuchadnezzar corrects himself to a little later. I see four men, and they're loose. They're the bonds of the three have vanished, walking, unhurt, apparently, in the midst of the fire. He could see from low level, and they have no hurt. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the mouth of the burning fiery furnace, the lower aperture, where if it's anything like my dust destructor visit, you could just see that those roaring flues tearing from the center and turning a right angle and going straight up by the flue effect. He calls them by name, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, ye servants of the Most High God, come forth, come hither. And they came forth out of the midst of the fire. And verse 27, princes, governors, captains, counselors, not the entire list, the hundreds and hundreds that were out there in the open air, but the most senior men now, the list is truncated, are close in, and they're observers. They see this astonishing preservation, this miracle, upon whose bodies the fire had no power, nor was an hair of their head singed, neither were their coats changed, nor the smell of fire had passed on them. The effect on the king was so dramatic, verse 28. But listen carefully to what he says. His unbelief, this pagan king, who's already had a tremendous revelation given to him from Daniel, from God, in the dream earlier. This man is so obdurate and so determined. Look at the qualified, limited extent of his response. Even though he's shocked and stunned beside himself, he's enough in control to reveal his heart. Verse 28, then Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He's not going to call him his God. Who hath sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him. It's nothing to do with Nebuchadnezzar. It's their God. It's their angel. It's their preservation. Yes, he says, they have changed the king's word. I am going to have to reverse my decree of demanding submission from the Jews or destruction. And yielded their bodies. They would have died rather than acknowledge there was any other God but their own. Yielded their bodies that they might not serve nor worship any God except their own God. But that's all he acknowledges, that they've got a God who has great power, but he's not the only one. And he's not going to give up his Babylonian gods, nor his own ways. Verse 29, under the compulsion of God, I believe, therefore I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort. No Babylonian God has ever done this, nor could, so far as we think. So we must acknowledge the Jewish God, and they must have peace from us. A complete reversal. The miracle has caused a reversal of policy. The only loss of life were 3, 4, 5, 6 heroes of the Babylonian army, and everyone is preserved. The miracle is not just a miracle of preservation of 3 men, which includes that, of course. It's a miracle for the preservation of the people of God and the plan of salvation. No emperor, however mighty, can defy God in the plan of salvation, can obstruct his purposes. How gentle God is to Nebuchadnezzar. He's letting him out on license for a little longer. Bodily, he's unhurt. He's suffered a humiliation. He's had to find a neat way round it. But his policy has been completely changed. What a contrast! World empires working by violence. God sets it all back so that his policy is not obstructed in the gentlest imaginable manner. What a sophistication is here in the book of Daniel. And what lessons for us? Because in this there is symbolism, that there is protection for us. And the Son of God is with us in every trial. And we shall be unhurt, maybe not bodily. Oh yes, they execute us. World power may execute, imprison, whip, scourge, hurt, but when we enter heaven, there will be nothing taken from us by world power. Ultimately, spiritually and eternally, we're unharmable because God is with us. So we should never be afraid, and we should never be disloyal to God, and never recoil from any test which he gives us. I wanted to say so much more about this passage, dear friends, but that's all really we have time for. But look at the last verse. Then the king promoted. The Hebrew word really is prospered rather than promoted. And I think in the days of the King James translation, the words were pretty similar. You could promote somebody's interests without literally promoting them. The King James translators knew that. But nowadays we should read prospered. They weren't promoted. They were brought as governors. They were sent back as governors. But this time with the king's approval, untouchable, unharmable, unlike before. Now that's not a promise to us, but the promise is that God is with us no matter what. World power is coming to an end. Babylon would fall. Even at the height of Nebuchadnezzar's power, God just raises a finger and his genocide policy is brought to an end. God can intervene. And he's telling us this. World powers are just on license. They'll all come to an end. Communism, we see it, we saw it suffer a great setback a few years ago. It's still got a considerable, a vast part of the world under its control. but it will fall, maybe before the end of time. Islam, where it holds sway, seems to be immovable and so powerful. But no, it's like any world empire. The scientific humanism of the Western world and its anti-Christian morality, gaining power all the time. We see it in our own land. We see it in Europe. We see it in the United States. Taking control, making illegal righteousness and legalizing unrighteousness. Sanctions coming in. I'm an old man. If the world goes on, some of you young people may live to see some awful sanctions against your practice of the faith. In the next few years, who knows? We pray for the preservation of God as a Christian faith, but it won't last. Whether Christ ends it by his coming or before, he throws down empires. He gives them so long and he humbles them. And that's what we're seeing here. In this particular chapter, we're seeing the humbling of Nebuchadnezzar in his plan to destroy the people of God. He had a vicious intention. Don't be naive as you read the chapter. But the power of God is with us. And whether we shall suffer persecution, setbacks, distress, the power of God ultimately is with us as God's people. Let's close by singing the hymn 550. Hymn number 550.